I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Russia's war on Ukraine grinds on after almost 8 weeks of intensive fighting, including the targeting of civilians and non-military sites. While the outmanned and outgunned Ukrainian forces prevented Russia from capturing and holding key cities like Kyiv, scenes of devastation and stories of suffering and misery by the civilian population are shocking, to say the least. Now Putin's mission is to capture the Donbas region and get a bigger toehold in the eastern part of the country. Today on Radio Times, where is this war headed? What are the tactics and strategies that both sides are using? We begin with Malcolm Nance. He's a former military intelligence analyst, former chief petty officer in the U.S. Navy. He posted recently on Twitter, "I'm done talking." He's now a member of the International Legion of Territorial Defense of Ukraine and joins us from an undisclosed location in Ukraine. Malcolm Nance, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Well, I'm glad to be back.
Well, we're happy to have you back. What was the precipitating incident or event that you decided to go from talking about Russian aggression to doing something about it?
Well, first off, I spent quite a bit of time here before the invasion, about a month and a quarter, studying the Russian invasion routes, studying the evacuation routes that have to be used in this country, going and getting a very good lay of the land, including going down to the battlefront in Donetsk. In fact, my interpreter was the same interpreter that one of your next guests, Matt Gallagher, used.
Oh, fascinating.
He was trapped in Donetsk on the first day of attack, on D-Day. And she was calling and telling us, we're probably not going to live another day. We're being bombarded with hundreds and hundreds of rockets and missiles. And to hear my friends, people who I know, people that I care about, saying that they were going to die in this Russian aggression, this war of choice, where they decided they were coming to eliminate Ukraine as a culture, eliminate it as a nation, eliminate it as a language, and ethnically cleanse the population, which we're already seeing out of southern Ukraine now. They're moving people out into Russia the same way Stalin did. So by D plus three, by the time D-Day, plus 3 days, when President Zelensky called for the formation of the International Legion for the Territorial Defense of Ukraine, which people are calling the Ukrainian Foreign Legion, I was pretty much sure that I was going to go and assist. Mm-hmm. And I had actually been jokingly asked by the commander general of the Joint Task Force in Donetsk if I ever considered joining the army at age 60. And, I jokingly said no. But a week later, I was signed up and heading on my way back to Ukraine.
Have you seen fighting? Have you been engaged in fighting with the Russian military?
Well, I've certainly seen fighting. I can't say that I've personally been engaged, but that's not my mission right now. And, there are forces that are out there. The Ukrainian Legion has to is a force that's plussed up. It's built up mainly majority of Americans. But there are people from 52 nations here. Organizing out into units and being prepared to go out into the current battlefront out in eastern Ukraine. But I've certainly seen the results of Russia's mass murder of civilians in this country. This is not an army. Let me make that clear to your listeners. This is not an army, the Russians. They are a horde of men with very poor leadership, very almost zero discipline, and they are mass murdering civilians with impunity, rape, theft, all of those things that you see on television, they are happening. And one other thing, Marty, a little earlier you said that the Ukrainians were outmanned and undermanned and outgunned. Undermanned by a bit, there are actually now more Ukrainian forces in the field with the reserves, with organizations like the Legion that are part of the Ukrainian army, than there are surviving Russian forces. And the Ukrainians destroyed three Russian combined arms armies in the north. And what remnants are left over of that, the dregs, are being sent back down to Donetsk for a new offensive. But I don't think they're going to succeed in any way in this country.
What is the mission of the Legion? Is it different from the Ukrainian military?
No, the Legion is, the International Legion is an organization that is part of the Ukrainian army. We have contracts with the government of Ukraine, with the Ministry of Defense. We have ID cards of the Ukrainian army. We are subordinated to Ukrainian officers, and we go in the field with Ukrainian commanders and are married up to other Ukrainian battalions. The only difference is it's made up of Americans, Korean, Japanese, men and women as well. We have a lot of American female combat vets who are out here, and they are all combat veterans. And these aren't the people that you've seen in some news reports who are out on the battlefield, don't have equipment, things like that. Those people are called freelancers. They didn't join the Legion, which is the only legitimate authorized combat force in the Ukrainian army for foreign fighters.
How well armed are you? And even talking about the Ukrainian military, we know that President Zelensky wants more weapons to use against the Russians and also to defend his country. Are you close to the kind of weaponry that you need in order to be successful?
Well, let me talk down at the ground level. The weapons that we need, we have. They're never going to be to the order, to the same scale as the U.S. Army. Not everyone's going to have night vision. Not everyone's going to, have the fanciest sniper weapon systems. But we have a lot of weapons from the United States. Early on, it was very spotty. But can I point out that the Legion is only 8 weeks old. And this war is just barely 8 weeks old. So, there's always, growing pains of an organization. But that is different than the strategic requirements of the nation of Ukraine. One of the things that the Russians have, they actually have only one advantage in this war besides, air power, and the Ukrainians are sort of holding that off. They have long-range artillery, and that is what they're killing civilians with. They're not going in and shooting them like you see in Bucha. First, they bombard them and try to kill and wipe everybody, set villages on fire, and then get them to come out, and they go and rape and pillage and murder. And you can just see those, the United Nations has documented lots of that stuff in this country. We need to provide the Ukrainians with long-range precision rocket fire that we have in the U.S. Army with the M420 multiple-launch rocket system or the HIMARS multiple-launch rocket system, which can outrange them by double what we have right now. And smart artillery rounds that, can fly 100 kilometers and then release an anti-tank round and destroy tanks. This is the sort of technology the Ukrainians are asking for in addition to others. But I personally think that those weapon systems would be game changers in the current event. The Russians just could not set up artillery and survive.
Is there any evidence that the U.S. or even NATO will provide that kind of weaponry?
Well, we've already seen NATO providing weaponry. The United States is, they they're on the verge of announcing another $800 million in weapon systems out there. But we have new artillery that was provided by the Czechs. That's very long range. The United States is providing long range artillery shells for those. We're plussing this up. You have to operate within space and time, right? In physics. So you can't just take a tank that's in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, or even in Primessens, Germany, and make it magically appear on the battlefield in Ukraine. They have to be put on trucks. They have to be moved and mobilized. And I think everyone is trying as best as they can to make sure that the Ukrainians are getting it. And the Ukrainians understand that and are making it clear to the United States that logistics chain is what's keeping this country alive, because this is a war where the Russians are determined to erase the country.
Why do you think, and Russia, and frankly others, predicted early on that Russia would essentially win this war within a matter of days, and here we are almost 8 weeks into the war in and on Ukraine, why do you think Russia has underperformed the way they have?
Well, first off, pardon me if I digress, but on MSNBC, I was one of the few analysts that was saying the thing that the U.S. news media was getting wrong was they were playing all this B-roll footage of Russian tanks on exercises and Russian aircraft and Russian helicopters. And when I came back from Ukraine, I said, hey, you guys know they have an army, right? They have a really good NATO-style army with senior leadership in the non-commissioned officers ranks, officers with combat experience, 100,000 reservists with combat experience. And these people, when this country was invaded, they wanted to fight down to the little old lady who was filling Molotov cocktails.
I remember those images. Yes.
Yeah, but they're disappointed they couldn't use the Molotov cocktails because the Ukrainian army held them off so well in the northeast part of the country. And you know, they used U.S. weapon systems like the Javelin, like the Stinger, with the expertise you would expect of the United States. The Russian horde, you know, people refer to them as orcs, like the orc army from Lord of the Rings, right? You know, they are sort of like that. They're undisciplined. They drink. They steal out. They go through houses to maraud, to steal alcohol. And then they come out and they commit murders and rapes and all these things. And on the battlefield, they don't control those large swaths of red that you see on the maps on television, on the big board, right? They only control the road that they are on as far as they can see. And the Ukrainians are in their rear destroying their fuel. That's why we could destroy the three combined arms armies. And now Russia is trying to reorganize that into a strip along Russia's border. Right. I don't think that the Russians have been overestimated. I think the Ukrainian army has been underestimated.
Well, you said, as you mentioned on MSNBC, you also said this on Radio Times when we had you on very early on in the war, that Ukraine could win this war. And it sounds like you're doubling down on that. You see victory?
I was a lone voice.
I know. I remember that.
We might have been March 3rd or somewhere around there, because I made that prediction on air on MSNBC when I worked for MSNBC. And I said, I'm going to call it right now. The Ukrainians can win this war entirely. It really is about morale. It really is about the heart of the people and the weapon systems that they're getting. But they've been doing brilliantly with what they started this war off with. You know, it's not the size of the dog in the fight. It's the size of the fight in the dog. And the Russians just messed with the wrong country. It's just as simple as that. And they are paying for it in blood, their own blood. But in retaliation, they are trying to take a bite out of this country territorially. And like the city of Mariupol, they want to raise it, fill it with ethnic Russians from other parts of Russia, and declare it a part of the Russian Federation. And, you know, the war be danged. But I think the Ukrainians have enough combat capacity, and if they've decided they're going to take their land back, they could take back even Donetsk and Luhansk, maybe not Crimea, but mm-hmm. We'll see how it goes.
Are you there for the duration, Malcolm? We're almost out of time.
Yeah, I am. Until this war is won.
Until this war is won or over, whatever that looks like.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's part of our contract till the national emergency is lifted.
That is Malcolm Nance, and he's a former military intelligence analyst, former chief petty officer in the U.S. Navy, and now a member of the International Legion of Territorial Defense of Ukraine. Malcolm Nance, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's my pleasure.
And we are going to talk more about the war in Ukraine after this very short break. We've got two more guests who'll be joining us in just a minute and a half. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Russia says it's embarking on a new phase of its war against Ukraine, almost 8 weeks since the start of the invasion. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said the goal is the complete liberation of Donetsk and Luhansk in the Donbas region in the east. An intensive assault has begun with more advanced long-range weapons that have battered the city of Mariupol to the ground, where an estimated 100,000 civilians are hiding out, short of food and water. 2 months ago, Russia and many experts predicted Ukraine would fall within a matter of a few days. Instead, the Ukrainian military and civilian volunteers have proved to be a determined, wily, and resourceful military force, while President Zelensky continues to pressure NATO and the U.S. to help them win the fight. Joining us now is Matt Gallagher, former U.S. Army captain, Iraq War veteran. He wrote three novels, Empire City, Youngblood, and Kaboom, and was recently in Ukraine training civilians how to fight. Matt Gallagher, it's been a couple of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be back with you, Marty.
Also with us is Dimitri Gorenberg, senior research scientist for CNA, also an associate at the Harvard University Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies. He's an expert on the Russian military and Russian foreign policy. Dimitri Gorenberg, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And I want to make sure our listeners can always join us during this hour. You can either email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Dimitri, let me begin with you and talk about this new phase of the war, this targeting of eastern Ukraine, this Donbas region. What is the significance of this military approach from Russia?
Well, this is kind of the fallback plan for Russia having failed to take Kiev. And what they're trying to do now is to surround the main main Ukrainian force that has been fighting in the Donbas against the Russian-supported Donetsk and Luhansk republics. And basically, it's too hard because of the Ukrainian forces are dug in, it's too hard to go at them straight from the east. So they're trying to surround them from the north and south. And the goal is to basically occupy the entirety of the Donetsk and Luhansk regions and then, potentially at that point to declare a victory, because that's officially, that's the war aim and has been from the beginning. Obviously, Russia was doing much more than that in the early phases of the war, but as far as the announced aims of the so-called special operation, it was to liberate the Donbas.
And is this a more friendly part of Ukraine for Russia, in that there are something like, or were, 15,000 separatists who support Russia? Are they more likely to find a more friendly civilian population in this part of Ukraine?
I think at this point, probably not. If you had asked me this question 8 years ago, then the answer is yes. That was the part of the Ukraine that was more pro-Russian. But the war changed a lot. And I mean, when I say the war, I mean the long-term war that began in 2014. Mm-hmm. And many Ukrainians who were perhaps Russian-speaking even, who were used to be more sympathetic to Russia, have changed their positions over time. And so there are a few collaborators, certainly on the margins. We're seeing that in some of the occupied territories. But the bulk of the population is, regardless of their language, regardless of things like that, their previous political positions, are very much against the Russian invasion. So no, I don't think they're going to find a lot.
And do you think 8 weeks of war have hardened them even further against Russia?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's hard to be sympathetic to a force that's bombing you and killing your friends and relatives.
Matt, I'll get to you in just one moment. Let me just ask you one more question, Dimitri, and this is about Mariupol. That if you've been watching, you just see the flattening of this particular city. There's this plant where people are hiding out. Putin said recently, or I guess it was actually yesterday, that he wants to block this industrial zone, and I'm quoting here, so that even a fly couldn't get through. What are the designs on Mariupol? Just to erase it from the earth?
Well, I don't think that was the original design. What happened is that Mariupol resisted, and resisted very effectively. And so the Russian military chose to use artillery and bombing and so forth to destroy the resistance. And the reason why it's significant is because it's a port that's on the coast. And two, it's on the it's the one place that's still holding out on the so-called land bridge, from Russian territory to Crimea. So it's kind of in the way for that connection from the Russian point of view.
Matt Gallagher, let me get you in on the conversation. You went to Ukraine in early March. You and two other veterans of war, recent wars, to train civilians, Ukrainian civilians, to be able to defend their city. You went to the city of Lviv. What made you decide to take this bold action?
It seemed like a direct way we could help. One of my friends and fellow trainers, Adrian Vonnenberger, had a connection to the Lviv City Council. They were mobilizing the civilian defense force. You know, this was early in this part of the invasion. The Russian military was already pushing towards Kyiv. It seemed very possible that they'd even turn their attention to Western Ukraine, where Lviv is. And this group of regular folks, bus drivers, welders, lawyers, wanted to fight back. They didn't have any military training, and we felt like we could fill that gap. So we got on a plane on February 28th, and we were there a couple days later, and we had 60 Ukrainians very eager to learn how to shoot, move, and communicate in an urban combat environment. And it was on the three of us to teach them everything we knew and to meet this need.
Well, you wrote about this in Esquire, you know, day one, day two. Here's for what you wrote on day two. Men and women, old guys in their 60s, a handful of teenage boys, stout and thin, checkpoint uniforms and camping gear and exercise clothing. They came because we asked them to. And these were 2 weeks of training in urban warfare? Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, you know, just kind of basics, room defense in buildings, moving as a fire team and a squad-sized element, outdoors, learning how to teaching 50-year-old lawyers how to bound across an open field. The idea being that these are folks who have already expressed the will and resolve to fight if the war does indeed come to their neighborhoods and their homes. We wanted to give them some skills to not just survive in such an environment, but maybe even thrive in it, right? So they're not running out into the middle of the street, dying a very heroic but pointless death. Mm. That they have some semblance of how to defend themselves and their families if they see Russian tanks or Russian infantry squads, moving into their areas and their terrain.
As you mentioned, this was early March, so that's a month ago. Were they able to use the skills that you taught them?
Thankfully, they've not yet had to. You know, the war has come to Lviv in the form of cruise missiles, but the Russian military has not pushed that far west. The training goes on, right? So we were able to hand it off to some other folks that specialists that are able to continue these people's training, so that if and when the war does reach Lviv, these people will be ready. And and we also taught them some other resistance tactics, right? That picking up a gun in a time of war is a heavy thing. Yeah. Especially for people who aren't soldiers. So we taught some other classes, information gathering, medical training, some other things. So for people that want to support the resistance effort if need be, but don't find themselves willing to pick up a rifle when the time comes.
What did they teach you?
Oh gosh, something I want to stress to your listeners is the national will and resolve that we see on television screens is so real. It was so inspiring and so powerful to me. It really ended up being one of the more fulfilling experiences of my life because of them in that regard. I know how this sounds to some Americans. It seems like something from a past century almost, but it's heroic. It's real. It's unified. These are people fighting for. It's an existential threat, and they're fighting for their lives. They're fighting for their country that they believe in. It's real and it's meaningful.
And that is Matt Gallagher. He's an Iraq War veteran. He's also a fiction writer, a novelist, and he was recently in Ukraine training civilians how to fight. He and two other veterans went to Lviv and spent a couple of weeks there in early March. Dmitry Gorenberg is with us as well, senior research scientist at CNA, an expert on the Russian military and Russian foreign policy. And again, you can join us. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Dmitry, picking up on what Matt Gallagher just said, but also what Malcolm Nance was saying earlier in the hour about, the Ukrainian military versus the Russian military. And the question is why the Russian military has frankly done so poorly in Ukraine. They spent months, you know, sitting on the border ready to invade, and yet they have not been able to have this easy victory that they envisioned. What went wrong, do you think?
Well, a lot went wrong. But I'll hit the main points. There was a bad plan. First of all, they were attacking the second largest country in Europe after Russia itself, and they just didn't have enough. I mean, it was a large force. It was 150,000 or more. But it's if your goal is to occupy entire country, they just didn't have enough force to do that. And rather than focusing on one area, they focused on five at the same time: the south, the east, the north, everywhere. And so they were unfocused. That was one. Two, there's the morale issue, and I think this is critical. There were a lot of reports early on that the soldiers that were sent to fight weren't even told. Until either right before the invasion or even once they were already crossing into Ukrainian territory, that they were in the middle of an actual war rather than on exercises. Okay. So that when they encountered resistance and they saw their buddies and their units being shot, that impacted morale. So the more the Ukrainian fighters, the Ukrainian army, as Malcolm said, and everyone says, they were defending their homeland. Their morale was really high. They knew what they were doing. The Russian side, the soldiers on the ground, didn't really know what they were doing. And as they met strong resistance, that morale plummeted even farther. So you kind of end up in a vicious circle where things get worse and worse, and your force gets bogged down, and discipline disappears, and then you start seeing some of these war crimes and things like that. But that was the second thing. I'll just add one more, which is that you fight how you train, and we've seen clearly that there were aspects of Russian training there were gaps in terms of communications. They clearly they were using cell phones, they were using unsecure communications, probably because that's kind of what they were doing on exercises, because they didn't like their radios. The radios are clunky, and so they just go back to what they know. And that those communications can be intercepted. The locals can see them coming, and they end up calling in the locations, and they get attacked, and their columns get destroyed. So I could go on, but those are some of the main things.
No, those are important. And Matt, let me just go back to you as someone that has spent some time training Ukrainian civilians, but also as an Iraq War veteran yourself. This idea of morale and defending your country, just how powerful a belief that is when in a war zone. Can you speak to that?
Sure. Yeah, a shared sense of purpose. Our trainees were kind of representative of the entire middle class of Western Ukraine. Certainly, these folks have their differences politically, socially, religiously. That almost all has been put to the side for this. And democracy is messy. I think we as Americans can understand that. But since the Euromaidan protests in 2014 and early 2015, Ukrainians, particularly the younger generation, have come to believe that this is their future. The democracy is their future, and they believe in it. They want it, right? They fought for it then, and they were victorious, and they intend to fight for it again and be victorious again. Speaking to the tactics that were just mentioned, we were teaching classes showing our civilians, videos of the Russian soldiers doing it wrong, right? Wow. Bunching up under fire, and being able to give them live classes of what not to do if you were them, and then B, well, how would you handle if this is your city and they're bunching up like this? Let's pretend this is Lviv. How do you respond? How do you ensure that you push out this invading army effectively, right? So being able to utilize that, essentially 12, 24 hours after it, you know, this is happening in central and eastern Ukraine, raises the morale of even our Ukrainian civilians even more, because A, they're seeing their army succeed and thrive and beat back the invaders, and also they're learning what to do. So it's just kind of reinforcing itself and emboldening these people for the fight even more.
Here's a caller that has a question for you, Dmitry, saying, what about Russia's test of their intercontinental ballistic weapons? What is that signaling? And it seems like Russia's operating in similar ways to other pariah nations like North Korea. What do you make of that?
Well, Russia has been signaling with nuclear weapons from even before the conflict started, and either in statements or in tests and exercises and things like that. And the goal here is to deter NATO and particularly the United States from getting involved. And so that's what that rhetoric is about. That's what those tests are about, is to highlight that, hey, we have nuclear weapons. We're willing to use them if the U.S. gets involved. So this is a fight, you know, Putin wants to make it a fight between Russia and Ukraine, and not a fight at this point. Maybe Ukraine is a proxy of NATO, but not a direct fight with NATO, because that's a fight on the conventional terrain that Russia can't win. And so you want to go, so they're going with the nuclear messaging to keep the U.S. out, basically.
And it's worked so far, would you say? We're almost having a break here, but it's worked so far, Dmitry.
Well, I don't think U.S. had any intention of getting directly involved in the fight. Speaking and sending in U.S. troops, I think President Biden made that clear from the beginning. So you could say it worked, or you could say if they hadn't done it, it would have worked also, because the U.S. was not intending to get involved in that way.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Dmitry Gorenberg, senior research scientist at CNA. He's an authority on the Russian military, Russian foreign policy. Matt Gallagher, former U.S. Army captain, Iraq War veteran, recently in Ukraine training civilians, wrote about it in Esquire in a long piece called Notes from Lviv. And again, you can join us. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking about the war in Ukraine, the battle for the Donbas region, the Russian military, the Ukrainian military, civilians being trained to fight in this war. And again, our guests are Dmitry Gorenberg and Matt Gallagher. Matt, you wrote recently it was in the New York Times, a guest essay titled My Advice for American Veterans Who Want to Get on a Plane to Ukraine, where you talk about the fact that there is this Foreign Legion. We heard from Malcolm Nance, who's a member of the Foreign Legion, something like 50 countries represented there, an estimated 20,000 foreign fighters who are in Ukraine. What do you make of this?
I think it's an open question. I was really interested to hear Malcolm talk about joining the Legion and putting out the call for recruitment. When we were there in March, it was still kind of a organization being built on the fly. Yeah. And there have been reports of legionnaires getting out of the country and saying that they were under-equipped, and there was very little oversight from Ukrainian officers. And it sounds like the Ukrainian government is taking these lessons to heart and doing a better job of vetting legionnaires. Malcolm stressed that they only want combat veterans, snipers in particular, is what a Ukrainian general told Task and Purpose in an interview. It's an interesting thing. Yeah. The historical comparisons for a Foreign Legion are spotty at best. But if nothing else, it is certainly a public relations dream for the Ukrainian government, right? Having a prominent American veteran like Malcolm front and center, having soldiers from 52 or veterans from 52 countries across the world coming to support the fight for democracy. Time will tell what that means pragmatically on the ground. I mean, we do know that the Georgian National Legion, which is another paramilitary outfit, you know, has been fighting in Ukraine since 2014. And, you know, I've read and have heard that a lot of the more professional foreign fighters coming in, at least up until now, have chosen to join that outfit rather than the Ukrainian Foreign Legion. Though that may well be changing, as Malcolm pointed out, that outfit is only 8 weeks old.
You wrote about being in Krakow, Poland, on your way to Ukraine, and you described goons. You say they're easy to spot, loud and obvious, usually dressed in fatigues and sometimes adhering to extreme ideology. Do these more sort of loosely organized legions, do they invite a certain kind of person that you know, is there to essentially just massacre other people for their own personal reasons rather than political reasons?
You know, I don't think the legions invite these people so much as war just kind of attracts strange folks from all over. You know, we got there so early. We were watching all these kind of different programs kind of slowly coming in. You know, goons, these kind of, you know, maybe they're military veterans themselves. Maybe they're just kind of wannabes and posers that have bought a lot of equipment and figured this is their time to go make something of themselves. A lot of, you know, representatives from the business side of armed conflict were starting to pour into Poland and Western Ukraine when we were there, so it was a bit like Casablanca, watching all these different programs come in. As for goons specifically, you know, part of the reason I wrote about this was not just to try to deter folks who might fit this bill who want to help Ukraine in some foggy way, but maybe don't have the practical skills or experience to actually do so on the ground. You know, it's also to kind of help raise the alarm for you know, the local authorities in Ukraine that you have some people who may be misrepresenting themselves coming in, and it's on you, unfortunately, to bear the burden of vetting them. You know, just speaking from personal experience, the Lviv power brokers that we met with did an excellent job of making sure we were who we said we were. We had to do kind of a thorough interview before we got to meet with our trainees. So, you know, extrapolating that across the country with these potential legionnaires, I think, is vital.
Let me go back to you, Dmitry, and actually go back to something that Malcolm Nance said at the start of the show, and he has said this on other venues and on this show as well, which is that he is optimistic that Ukraine can win this war. And I'd just be curious, here we are 8 weeks, you know, there's much that we do not know. We obviously can't predict the future, but do you have a sense about where this war is going?
Well, I think that right now it's very difficult to tell, but we'll have, I think the next 2 to 3 weeks will determine a lot. So the Russians are looking to, as I mentioned earlier, to take the Donbass. I think if they succeed at that, they might well declare victory. And, you know, I mean, Ukraine, I imagine, will not accept that. But, you know, from the Russian point of view, they will have succeeded, at least on some level. If that offensive bogs down, it's very hard for them to spin it as a victory, if they can't even take the Donbass. So I think that's going to determine, you know, this current fight that's just started this week is so critical for what happens going forward. I think that the important point to keep in mind is that regardless of the outcome, though, of, you know, even if Russia does take the Donbass, it's going to be, you know, they will have taken more casualty, they will have lost more equipment, so they will largely at that point be more or less a spent force. So the likelihood of them moving on beyond the Donbass is, I think, very low. But they could then, like I said, declare victory and regroup for some period of months or years. And then, you know, try again. So that's the danger, and that's why this fight right now is so important to preserve Ukrainian independence, really.
Well, and I don't want to get ahead of myself, but how do you govern over a region that you have destroyed, essentially? If you look at Mariupol and, you know, other parts of the Donbass that would be and are being targeted by Russia, then, you know, how do you control it once you've so-called won it?
Well, it's difficult, and that's why they're doing things like setting up filtration camps and these other kind of terrible things. Where the goal is to try to remove from the population and arrest people who might be leaders of a resistance. Mm-hmm. They're going to be facing potential attacks from Ukrainians in the territory they control. We saw in Kherson within the last couple of days a prominent collaborator. Who was killed in his car, by an unknown attacker. Yes. And I imagine there will be more of that kind of thing in the occupied territory in the time to come, with the idea of making that occupation as painful as possible for the Russians.
Horrifying. Here's an email from Jeff. He says, why don't the Ukrainian forces destroy more facilities in mainland Russia? This is a war, and it isn't a normal response. And isn't it a normal response to the Russian invasion? Dmitry, if I can toss that back to you, and Matt, I'd like to hear from you as well. But obviously, that would widen the war. Would it change the calculation, Dmitry?
So, I mean, they've been doing that a little bit and attacking key kind of logistics nodes and fuel depots and that sort of thing within Russian territory, kind of near the border. The problem is that they have limited resources, the Ukrainians do, and attacking just is costlier than defending, and so they have to be careful in terms of husbanding those resources. For protecting their own territory, so it's not from a military perspective, it's not necessarily sensible to take the fight. You know, as it may from a moral perspective, it may make people feel good that okay, they're taking the fight to the enemy.
Yeah.
But if that comes at the cost of being able to hold your own territory, that may just not be worth it. Now we have,
go ahead.
When there are opportunities to make these kinds of attacks that are highly symbolic, and we saw this with the sinking of the Moskva cruiser in the Black Sea, they take those opportunities because that is a big, those kinds of big actions are big morale boosters for Ukraine, particularly given that that ship was involved in this incident very early in the war with the with Snake Island, where the Ukrainian border guards who were essentially told them to go to hell.
Yeah.
And then that was the ship that was sunk. So there is that symbolism that's involved, but they want to just be careful try to preserve the relatively limited resources that they have.
Matt, here's a question for you from Joseph. He says, do your guests think there are active duty U.S. military in Ukraine helping the effort against Russia? And I realize, you have limited knowledge, but any thoughts about that, Matt?
Active duty, I personally am 99.99% sure no.
Okay.
There's many veterans working in a variety of spectrums. Some trainers like we were. Others, foreign fighters, as legionnaires, both in the Ukrainian Foreign Legion, like Malcolm Nance, and the Georgian National Legion. There's a number of them that I know are working in a variety of humanitarian capacities, and there's also a bunch in the NATO countries doing work like this in Poland and Romania. We do know there are active duty troops in those countries as well. President Biden just announced that we'll be training some Ukrainian soldiers on artillery, for example, right? But the geopolitical consequences of sending in even a covert group of active duty troops are too consequential. So, but a lot is happening with folks who have already spent their time in uniform, and are you know, going over there as volunteers.
Here's a question from Linda Dimitra. I'll toss this to you. She says, analysts say Russia miscalculated their strength and Ukraine's ability to defend itself. How about NATO and the U.S. miscalculations? Also, it seems Putin saw sanctions merely as the price Russia had to pay for Ukrainian territory. Did the U.S. see it that way, too? Do you see sanctions as an effective weapon, if I can use that word, since we're talking about war, an effective weapon in war, especially this particular war?
Yes, but you have to remember the time horizons. So sanctions, I don't think anyone in the U.S. or anywhere else expected sanctions to stop the invasion. The goal of the sanctions at this point is to cause, to weaken Russia for the medium to long term, right? So that they are less able to rebuild the damaged parts of their military, to continue to build up their military going forward, and also to some extent to foment domestic opposition to the government. Not necessarily, you know, not necessarily directly over the war, although that there's some of that certainly as well. But the economic protests that I suspect will be coming, you know, in the next year or two, as the sanctions really begin to bite, will cause the Russian government to have to, you know, worry about domestic instability, to spend resources, you know, the Russian National Guard will have to go deal with those things. So all of those things hinder Russian adventurism or expansionism or whatever you want to call it, both in Ukraine and in the wider world. And I think that's the real goal of the sanctions at this point. Plus, of course, punishment, but that's clear. And the part of the question that was about, you know, whether Putin expected sanctions to be just the price, I think he did, but he didn't expect them to be this comprehensive. Mm-hmm. And to have, you know, this many countries sign on. Certainly the goal, the efforts now by the European countries to wean themselves off of Russian oil and gas are going to really hurt, you know, the Russian bottom line, you know, in terms of revenues going forward.
And Matt, we're almost out of time here, but I want to know your contact with the civilians that you trained in Ukraine. Do you stay in contact with them? And if you do, what are they telling you about the war?
I do. You know, I checked in with them just a couple days ago when that deadly cruise missile strike hit Lviv. And thankfully, you know, some I believe 10 people were killed. None of our folks, thankfully. You know, they describe, you know, the training's still ongoing. They're continuing to arm themselves and get personal equipment for themselves. Some of them who still had their families in Lviv in Ukraine when I was there have since sent their children and their spouses out. You know, Ukrainian men cannot leave the country under martial law. So you know, Western Ukraine very much remains a city on edge. You know, it's not the front, but it's certainly not a city at peace. And you know, my great hope is to be able to take my family someday to Lviv to see that beautiful city properly as it's meant to be seen during a time of peace.
Absolutely, Matt Gallagher. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's former U.S. Army captain, Iraq War veteran. He wrote three novels, Empire City, Youngblood, and Kaboom, recently in Ukraine, training civilians how to fight. Dmitry Gorenberg, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Senior research scientist at CNA, also an associate at the Harvard University Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies, an authority on the Russian military and Russian foreign policy. And we began with Malcolm Nance, who is in Ukraine fighting with Ukrainian military. To replay this hour and many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.